morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to talk about water quality now, and thank goodness this is someone else's problem. Nothing you do has anything to do with problems in Lake Champlain or any other waterways. It's the farms and big corporate polluters or somebody, right? Well, actually, we all have a role in making our world a cleaner place. And if you live in the Lake Champlain watershed, you do have a role in that lake's health. And if you live near any body of water, you're pretty much directly connected to what winds up in it. Okay, don't stress. We've all learned to use reusable bags. We're getting into the groove on composting. Trust me, you've got this when it comes to being a good neighbor to our waterways. Here to help us through it all are two people connected to a program called Rethink Runoff. Kristen Balchinot is conservation specialist with the Winooski Natural Resources Conservation District. Welcome, Kristen.
Hello, thanks for having me this morning.
Sure. And Dan Albrecht is senior planner for the Chittenden County Regional Planning Commissioner. And Dan, it's great to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And listeners, what questions do you have about runoff? Are you already taking steps to protect our waterways? You can let us know at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kristen, what is the goal of Rethink Runoff?
The goal of Rethink Runoff is to teach people what they can do to help improve stormwater quality, really across Vermont. Rethink Runoff serves 9 municipalities in the greater Burlington area, and we run programs like stream cleanup, rain barrel workshops, a summer water quality sampling initiative that is all done by volunteers. But what it's really all about is sharing with people what they can do to make a difference in their little corner of the world.
Who's part of the effort?
The effort is a combination of the Chittenden County Regional Planning Commission, the Winooski Conservation District, and the 9 towns that we serve, which are Burlington, Colchester, Essex, Essex Junction, Milton, Shelburne, South Burlington, Williston, and Winooski. But we also have a website with lots of information that is available to anyone, anywhere, and I think it's a great resource if people are wanting to learn more.
And that website is rethinkrunoff.org. Dan, can you actually measure the level of contaminants that are running into the lake?
Yeah, the state of Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation, has been doing sampling and modeling efforts on Lake Champlain for quite a while. And there's estimates in what are called the tactical basin plans for each of the sub-watersheds that drain into Lake Champlain. And so they estimate the volume of phosphorus running off from farm fields, from roads, from parking lots, and then what they call the different sectors. So there's the developed land sector, the neighborhoods, the roads, the commercial developments, agriculture, even erosion itself from the streams. And those are broad measurements. And then in some cases, there's individual sampling efforts going on as well, too.
What are the municipalities, Dan, that are involved in this project? What are they doing?
Right. So this is just with some of these efforts. So the effort that we run, the Rethink Runoff, again, it's a Chittenden County Regional Planning acts as the lead agency or administrator on behalf of the 9 municipalities that are subject to what it's called a municipal separate storm sewer permit, otherwise known as MS4 permit, and also includes 3 other non-municipal entities: the University of Vermont, Burlington International Airport, and the Vermont Agency of Transportation. Has to do with their presence near what are called impaired streams that are highly eroded because of years of stormwater runoff. So those 9 municipalities plus the 3 other entities have various permit requirements. 2 of them are related directly to our goal of education. We run advertisements promoting good practices at the home level. And then the engagement, the hands-on work that we subcontract with the Winooski NRCD to carry out the stream cleanups and tabling at farmers markets, rain barrel projects, things like that. So the other things the municipalities are doing are very, very broad. So they're overseeing any construction projects that disturb, an acre. They're looking over development projects to make sure that stormwater is being treated appropriately. They're taking care of their roads appropriately to be sure that there's not too much runoff. There's, in the case of our more urban municipalities here, they're doing the street sweeping. They're taking a giant vacuum cleaner and cleaning out the what are called the catch basements, the things under the grate in the road. Mm. They catch a lot of runoff. They get a lot of sediment trapped in there. They do the cleaning. And they're, very especially now with leaf fall recently, they're like, saw a lot of them out doing the street sweeping as well, too. So there are a variety of measures that those towns do to, manage stormwater.
Kristen, can one person really make a difference?
Absolutely. So we talk a lot about non-point source pollution being a big challenge that is facing the communities that we serve and communities across Vermont. Basically, this means that across the landscape, small actions that may have a negative impact on water quality can really add up over the course of an entire watershed. So similarly, small actions that have a positive impact on water quality can also really add up to make an important difference.
Dan, what types of things are we trying to keep out of our waterways?
Well, a lot of it really comes down to slowing the flow of water. So before there was much development, rain would fall. Storms are a normal thing, but there was most of the landscape was forest or field, and relatively little development. So when you think about your own property at one time, it was trees, it was bushes, it was whatever, it was a field that would absorb a lot of the rainfall. And what happened as development, continued is that there was by and large an issue of water is a problem. Water needs to be getting off my property. And so the easiest thing to do is to discharge it into the street, and then the street would go into the ditch in some cases, or into stormwater conveyances, the underground pipes, and then people would just find either the individual developer or the individual home builder or the person who built their own home or whatever. In the cities, it's get the water, get it into a pipe, and get it out of sight. And so we have this legacy of stormwater runoff directly into our streams, and for years that went on, and kind of out of sight, out of mind, and so that's how water was treated. So when we look at today, we're trying to sort of play catch up and get the water, infiltrate it, slow the flow of it. So you get all that water, you get a lot of sediment, which damages the ecosystem, especially in the small streams. It clogs up the nice places under the pebbles where the fish and little critters like to live, so it ruins that habitat, and it also carries phosphorus that's in the soil. It carries it into the lakes and stream, and phosphorus acts as a pollutant. In the more urban areas, of course, you get pollutants, you get metals, you have oil on the road, you have a lot of grit, you have sand, you have here's a weird one. It's the when you every time you brake, there's a tiny little bit of metals that come off of your brake, and all that. So there's actually little metals that all end up on the road. So when you think about we're fortunate we don't have heavy levels of toxic pollutants. It's primarily a flow and a sediment issue. But once you have all that excess sediment, it really messes things up. And we have a legacy of streams that would be considered flashy because they get all this huge runoff. They're highly eroded, and it just keeps making things worse. So it's kind of what were very slow, relatively shallow meandering streams have large gullies in them.
Mm.
All that. So yeah. Especially in the urban environment.
And instead of those things being on ground that could absorb it first, it's going on to impervious surfaces and then running right off into our lakes and streams.
Right, straight into a pipe. So that was the old system of handling stormwater. Now, you know, there's a much more requirements to, you know, if you see newer developments, you often see the big pond.
Right.
With, you know, and so that's, you know, now, especially, you know, in South Burlington and some of the more urban, you know, the requirement to retain the first 1 inch of water or 1.1 inches of water on the property before you're allowed to discharge it into the city's stormwater system. So, yeah, so a lot of catch-up going on, you know. So the towns are doing a lot of that work, you know, retrofitting old ponds or taking over ones that were put in a condo association in the 70s or the 80s or something like that, which fell into disrepair, and so they're taking those over and getting them up to standards.
Gotcha. Hey, let's take a call. We've got Karen calling in from Hardwick. Karen, thanks for calling the show.
Hi. I just find it curious that these people never mention two major sources of pollution.
Mm-hmm.
One being millions of gallons of high phosphorus acidic waste from Agrimark, which is dumped all over the farmland. And the other is the leachate from the dump in Coventry. I see them trucking tanker after tanker, and they take it to Montpelier and Barrie, put it through the sewage system, and it goes right into Lake Champlain.
All right. Let me get Dan or Kristen to respond to that, Karen. The high phosphorus waste that gets put on fields, also leachate, you know, from the dump up in Coventry. Are these things that, you know, are being looked at on how they can keep that out of our waterways?
Yeah, I'm going to punch you, Kristen, because you work a little bit more with the agricultural community.
Most of the sites that are mentioned are outside of work, so I'm not immediately familiar with them. But what I can say is that agriculture is a large source of phosphorus loading into Lake Champlain, and there also has been a lot of effort to work with farmers to install more lake-friendly practices, especially in the last, I would say, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of organizations, including conservation districts and Museum Extension, as well as the Agency of Agriculture itself, that are offering support to farmers to implement more lake-friendly practices that may involve doing a nutrient management plan so that farms are only spreading nutrients on the fields that really need them, or maybe doing an upgrade to some infrastructure in the barnyard, or doing something as simple as soil sampling the field so that farmers have a better idea of what is actually happening in their soil chemistry. So I think agriculture is moving in a good direction in the state, but it is certainly a big challenge and a big opportunity.
And I know the dump in Coventry, the waste site there, is lined, but is it... I think they test often, too, for that leachate, but can that be completely kept out of the water table and out of our waterways? Is that subject to either of you?
I might send that question to Dan. I'm not familiar with him.
I don't know enough about that issue there. I mean, I think all the sectors are kind of playing catch-up. You know, I think we've all of us, whether we're, you know, I work a lot with the urban and suburban communities here in Chittenden County. I think the other sectors, be it, you know, for example, the sewer plants have invested millions of dollars to really ratchet down the percentage of phosphorus that goes into the lake after they treat the sewage, you know, and so that's been a lot of improvements. I do know that, you know, the agricultural community is well aware of the issue. You know, they know everybody's looking at them, and I think, you know, by and large, they're all trying to do the right thing and working, you know, with the state and federal folks, both the state and the federal government, which is, you know, that's all our taxpayer money, are doing a lot more work to encourage, you know, better farming practices. And we're seeing an integration of I think, concern for agricultural runoff with also helping our river systems recover. So we're looking at, you know, ideally more of the stream bank plantings, you know, looking at that vital area next to the, you know, what's called the riparian corridor, and doing projects there. And I think, you know, just to pivot back to some of the work that Kristen's group does, as well as other groups around the state, the local watershed associations, you know, the stream bank plantings, That's a great way to get involved. You know, it creates habitat. It cuts down on the erosion, the loss of soil. Has a lot of natural benefits, and it takes time. But you know, some of these projects have really come to fruition over the years, and so there's a recognition that, you know, the floodplain is a key ingredient. So that means working, you know, if that land is important, you know, then working with farmers to do some conservation easements, you know, essentially you're paying them for that ecological value of the land adjacent to the rivers, you know, can go a long way to, there's a lot of phosphorus that's embedded
right
in the stream bank there.
Totally.
And stuff. And over centuries, you know, Vermont has, and people have straightened the rivers and channeled the rivers and dumped stuff in the rivers. They're not the pristine ecosystems they once were, and so we need to recover those.
Kristen, what are some things I can start doing right now to reduce the runoff?
I'm so glad you asked. So the first thing that's really easy is pick up trash or clear storm drains anywhere in town. A lot of people are surprised to learn that storm drains often lead directly to the nearest stream or lake without any type of cleaning or filtration. So picking up anything anywhere on the landscape that doesn't belong in our lakes is a great, easy thing to do. For folks that are managing properties, I have three suggestions of things they could do today or maybe this week. The first thing would be to either build a rain barrel or purchase a rain barrel to start capturing the rainwater that is running off of their roof. There's two benefits to this. The first benefit is that rain in a storm will be stored on site rather than sort of going over the highway and picking up all of the different pollutants that we talked about that exist on our roads to bring them down to the lake. But also it allows people to have a source of water to use to clean their tools or water their flower gardens later on in the middle of perhaps a dry summer. Another great thing for people to consider is how they are caring for their lawn. So we see runoff from lawns that could include fertilizers, pesticides. It's great to avoid those things as much as possible. And if people are considering amending their lawns with anything, we recommend that you take a soil test first so that you know what your lawn actually needs. And you could learn from the UVM Extension website how to take a soil test and where to submit that. The last note I want to share on lawn care is that there are some tests going on at UVM that are showing benefits of raising your lawnmower blade up to 3 inches high, so keeping your lawn a little bit longer throughout the summer, which encourages stronger root growth and also allows for better infiltration of water throughout the year. So those are some great simple changes you might be able to make with how you're managing your lawn. And finally, as winter is approaching, I really strongly consider that people, or urge that people consider changing the way that they use salt in the winter. We have noticed an increasing trend in chloride in some of the surface water sampling that we're doing. And if there's too much salt in our streams, a lot of the life that lives there, including the bugs and the fish, can't survive. So we encourage on a homeowner level that you get out as soon as possible and use more of a physical force to remove the ice rather than that chemical force of the salt. So using an ice chipper, trying to get out to shovel a few times, and then just spot treating in areas where you frequently walk with salt. But those are all sort of things on different scales that you could do to make a small difference today. And I definitely encourage you to reach out with questions or visit our website to learn even more about actions you can do, everything from planting a tree to redirecting where your gutter is outflowing on your property.
And Dan, what about things like dog waste or washing our cars?
Yeah, that's a big one. Dog waste issue is ongoing. We've seen a lot of improvement in that regard. We do a survey every 5 years, and we've seen, you know, good reported behavior on picking up dog poop compared to where we were 10, 15 years ago. So keeping that, keeping the efforts up on that is really great, although it is still disappointing to see you go for a walk. And
I know.
People put they put it in a bag, but then they leave it by the side. So anyway, that's more an aesthetic issue, but it's not long-term and not fun. The other thing I'd like to add to the great recommendations that Kristen made is the issue of just looking at your driveway. You know, driveways are really like a water conveyance system in many respects. So think about, like, you know, might be a thing of like, oh, great, it's all that water's running off my driveway. Isn't that neat and tidy? It's not my problem anymore. So take a look at your ditches, you know, along the side of your driveways. For those of you who live in more rural areas, you know, look at ways you can, if you've got the room, you know, divert some of that water onto your lawn or the end of your property. Try to think about not just discharging it right into the ditch, which is in the town right away, because then the road crew has to deal with all that excess runoff that's coming from your driveway, and all. So take a look at that, and especially, you know, in the urban context too. Maybe there's a way you can divert some of that water off of your driveway and make a small little depression with some plants, you know, sort of a mini rain garden.
Oh, that's great.
Infiltrate some of that soil, even some of that water before it runs just swooshing into the street.
So. Absolutely. The website is rethinkrunoff.org. I went and I was amazed to learn how close I live to the Winooski River. And so I have a direct line from my runoff right to the Winooski. I want to thank Kristen Balchunat and also Dan Albrecht for joining us. This was a very informative discussion. So thank you today.
Pleasure being with you. Thanks.
Thanks again.
All right. Take care, Kristen. CBS News is next. When we return, it's time to talk Brussels sprouts. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Last week, we learned about a veg most of us didn't know much about. That was burdock root. Today, I'm stepping up to the plate to discuss and defend the honor of Brussels sprouts. I'm guessing next week it will be another bee vegetable, perhaps beets, that I take on. But Brussels sprouts will grace many tables on Thanksgiving Day. Half of the diners will heartily dig in. The other half will make some noise as if they were handed something truly distasteful. Just remember that, Brussels sprouts lovers, just remember, it's more of those tasty little morsels for you, for everybody who doesn't like them. But here to chat about Brussels sprouts with me is Jael Polskamp, who raises them on her Kettle Song Farm in Worcester. Hello, Jael.
Hi.
And Tracy Medeiros, who has written several cookbooks, including the Vermont Farm Table Cookbook and the Vermont Non-GMO Cookbook. Tracy, thanks for being on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Well, thank you for having me, Rick.
And listeners, if you love the Brussels sprout or have a great way to prepare them, you can call us now at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jael, how did you become a Brussels sprouts farmer?
Well, I kind of just fell into it.
As one does.
Yeah. I was growing 25 different crops, going to the Montpelier Farmers Market, and I planted Brussels sprouts for the farmers market, but also because I love them. They're one of my favorite vegetables. And one year, Robert Kerrigan from Hunger Mountain Co-op called to ask if I had any Brussels sprouts because their supplier had run out, and I said, sure. It was a sleety, cold, miserable November day, a couple days before Thanksgiving, and I ran up and harvested everything I had left and brought them in to Hunger Mountain Co-op, and from then on, I started supplying them and started I don't know, getting a reputation as a supplier of Brussels sprouts and slowly grew into that crop. And then I left the farmer's market and just started doing wholesale Brussels sprouts and focusing on wholesale.
Well, describe your farm, Kettle Song Farm.
It is a hillside farm on the way up to Worcester Mountain. I grow a lot of rocks. And I have 68 acres, but only about 7 tillable on my land. Mm-hmm. Most of it's in woods. And then I lease 2 acres down the road and then 2 acres across the road.
Gotcha. Tracy Medeiros, I should have asked you this before I asked you to be on the show about Brussels sprouts. Which camp are you in the battle of the Brussels sprouts? Like or dislike?
I like them. I'm not a fan of Brussels sprouts boiled. However, right. I love them shaved and added to garden salads. And also, if you skewer them whole and grill them, they're really yummy. And, of course, I love them roasted.
Right. So you're a lover because the boiled Brussels sprout thing, that's just wrong, and we can talk about that. But that's not how you eat a Brussels sprout. So you have found the right ways, and we'll talk more about them and get some recipes. But you can sit on our side of the table, the Brussels sprouts lovers. Jael, what is the reaction you get from people when you tell them what you raise?
Surprise. when people see them the way that they grow, they're always shocked. No one realizes, a lot of people don't realize that they grow on a stalk, and they grow out the side of the stalk, right where the leaf comes out. So I used to take them to farmer's market on the stalk, and people would be surprised. But most people say they love them. When I tell them I grow Brussels sprouts, they say, oh, I really like Brussels sprouts. I hated them as a kid, but now I really like them.
Yeah, we do tend to find ways to enjoy them as we get older, most of us. Although this morning when I mentioned it on the morning show, there were groans of despair. So that's never good. And they're so cute, Jael. Are they easy to raise?
They're not.
Oh.
they're actually quite difficult, and everything wants to eat them, all sorts of insects. The deer love them, and they need a lot of fertility, and trace minerals like boron is very important in raising them. So it can be tricky. I know I just had a neighbor come by and ask me, she's been trying to grow them for years and can't get them to size up, and ask me, you know, what do you do? I top them. I do everything I'm supposed to do, and they just won't size up. And it really comes down to fertility. They really like chicken manure, I've come to realize.
Who doesn't?
My neighbors when I spread it.
Yes. Hey, Tracy, what should we know in general about Brussels sprouts when we go to prepare them?
Well, I have some tips for you, Rick.
Good.
Well, first of all, you should always, if you're going to cut them in half, always have the Brussels sprouts cut side down. And for the reason for that, it allows for them to caramelize perfectly while the outer leaves crisp up. And also, if you plan to roast your Brussels sprouts and you want them really crispy, the temperature is critical. I recommend 400 degrees or even 425.
So you're blasting them.
Exactly. And also, too, when you remove some of the outer leaves, if they're still in great condition or they just fall off, the sprout, just throw them on when you're roasting the trim sprouts, they'll crisp up, and they're almost like a little chip.
Oh,
so
that's
I would recommend
brilliant.
That.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Tracy.
And I like them, too, because they're high in vitamin C and K, and they're high in antioxidants, and they can reduce inflammation, and they're great in fiber.
Mm. Wow. You have really just taken it to another level for me.
I have.
These are things I have to pay attention to when I'm roasting them. Very simple little tips, but they do make a big difference in what you're doing. And how about a recipe for Brussels sprouts?
Sure. This one is from Kettle Song Farm, and it's one of my favorites. So if folks out there are looking for an easy, stress-free recipe to wow their family with, this is the one. It's Brussels sprouts with a creamy sriracha dipping sauce.
Mm.
And, Rick, you know, I'm sure most of your listeners know what sriracha sauce is, but just on the chance for some of those folks listening that don't,
right,
it's just basically a type of hot sauce or chili sauce,
mm-hmm,
and it's made from a paste of chili peppers, distilled vinegar, garlic, sugar, and salt, and you can easily find it at your local grocery store. And so basically with this recipe, very simple, you a pound of Brussels sprouts, and it should feed about four as a side dish, and then three medium garlic cloves minced, two tablespoons of virgin coconut oil. And if some folks out there are saying, well, what's the difference between virgin coconut oil versus regular coconut oil? Well, basically just the regular coconut oil uses the dry coconut kernel, where the virgin coconut oil is extracted from the fresh milk of coconut, and it maintains the aromas and the antioxidants, so it's a really rich coconut oil, the virgin one. So I like to use that. And just some salt and pepper, and then it has this lovely, creamy sriracha dipping sauce. And it makes about a half a cup, and you just need some sour cream, mayonnaise, some prepared horseradish, some sriracha sauce, that extra kick, some garlic powder, and some cayenne pepper, and you just mix that up. And then you're going to preheat your oven to 400 degrees, as I mentioned earlier, so they're nice and crispy.
Right.
And then you're just going to lightly oil a rimmed baking sheet. You're going to put the Brussels sprouts in a medium bowl, and then you're going to combine it with the garlic and oil, because oil is also critical when you're cooking with Brussels sprouts, so you get that nice crisp.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're just going to put them on a baking sheet, and as discussed earlier, cut side down, so you get a nice caramelized Brussels sprout.
Yep.
Season it with a little salt and pepper. Then you're going to bake it until it's golden brown, and then you dip it in that fabulous creamy sriracha dipping sauce.
Oh,
and
man,
it will be gone in a minute.
Killing me.
You're going to turn your back, and you're going to look, and your family's going to be, like, inhaling it.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. All right. And we've got Jim calling in from the beautiful town of Two Town Greens. It's Chelsea, Vermont. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. What a great show again.
Thank you.
I've got a question for both these gals. You haven't said anything about roasting the Brussels sprout stalks, the stems.
Oh.
I learned that from Healthy Living up in Burlington. You just take your peeler and you peel off the, like celery, you peel off the extra, that tough outside, and you can cut them up or roast them in the whole stem. And they're really great. I'd like your feedback on that.
Interesting. Jael, do you do that?
I have actually eaten the stem, but what I do eat are the leaves. I love the leaves. They're like collard greens. I even think that the flavor is better.
Hmm.
So all summer I will harvest the leaves and eat those until the sprouts start to grow. But I'm sure it's similar to like a broccoli stem.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can eat the whole plant pretty much.
How about you, Tracy? Anything you've ever done with the stems?
Well, I use the stems in when I'm making stocks, but
yeah, yeah.
I've never had them roasted, but now I will. Jim, you have me hooked. Now I need to do that.
How about Jimmy coming through with the stems for the Brussels sprouts? Really great
Love
suggestion.
It.
Yeah. And it does make sense. Tracy, I mean, we don't talk about this much, but making stock, you can save a lot of parts of vegetables that you might not cook and eat, but throw that in a bag and keep it maybe in the freezer, and then when you want to make a nice vegetable stock, pull it right out, and that's a great way to get that soup started. Let's talk to George in Middlebury. He's next. George, how you doing?
Good, good. I have a question for, so I've successfully grown Brussels sprouts in the past. This year was a battle between rabbits, woodchucks, lack of water, et cetera.
Right.
And so the ones that did make it through, some did quite well. And I had one that never produced any Brussels sprouts, minus, you know, they were the size of basically peas coming out of the leaf, at the edge of the leaves, except that it produced one Brussels sprout at the top, the size of a softball, like a cabbage. And I realize they're related to cabbages, but have you ever seen that before?
Jael.
Yeah. So you actually should pinch that top off, like mid-September, and that will help the Brussels sprouts size up. So the energy isn't going into, like, growing the plant tall. And then that's also where the seeds come from. So if you take that off, then the sprouts will size up.
Okay, so we have one giant softball-sized one we were going to cut in half and roast, and maybe it'll be okay, and maybe it won't. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
All right, George, but now you know how to handle it next year. Pinch that off come September. When they get that big, Jael, are they tasty, or do they kind of just like overgrown zucchini, not all that delicious?
Oh, no, so I'll pinch all the tops off, and I'll roast those. They're like the soft Brussels sprout leaves, and they're really tasty. So sometimes some restaurants actually really like them. They're, you know, they weigh less, so they're a little less pricey, and they crisp up really nice.
Oh, interesting. I'll tell you ways I like to do them, and then, Tracy, I'm going to ask you for another recipe. But I once found a recipe for blackening. You blacken Brussels sprouts. You kind of shave them fairly thin, and then blacken them in a pan. Love them in the cream sauce with bacon. Also roast it with capers and lemon brown butter. And another thing that I really enjoy, Pizza 44, which is in Burlington, makes a Brussels Caesar salad. And it's really, right? What a great idea. It really is delicious. All right, Tracy, back to you for another recipe.
Sure. And this one is also featured in the Vermont non-GMO cookbook as well. And, again, very simple, and it uses Bento's hot sauce. And for those listeners who aren't familiar with that hot sauce, it's made in a commercial kitchen right in Morrisville. And, again, very simple. This one uses a handful of ingredients. It serves four as a side dish, and it's roasted Brussels sprouts with infused Vermont maple syrup. So, basically, again, you're just going to take a pound of Brussels sprouts, trim them, have them lengthwise. Again, make sure you put it cut side down so it's nice and perfectly caramelized. One tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil, a little sea salt, and freshly ground pepper. You don't have sea salt, kosher salt is fine, and then just two tablespoons of the Bento's sauce, which is chipotle-infused Vermont maple syrup. Preheat your oven to 400 degrees, lightly oil a baking sheet, cut side down, and you're just going to mix, you know, the Brussels sprouts with the oil, the salt, and then you're just going to, you know, crisp them up about 5 to 7 minutes. Then you're going to drizzle some of that sauce on it and then cook it for another 20 minutes. And really, really tasty.
I am salivating here. This is really great stuff. How about you, Jael? You know, do you have advice for people on how to cook them properly?
Well, I think Tracy's given some great examples. I also love them raw. I love to make salad with them. I do a salad with Romano cheese and shallots and olive oil and lemon, and that's one of my favorites. I've discovered a restaurant down in New York who serves them with shishito peppers, roasts them with shishito peppers, and think that wouldn't be a good combo, but it's one of my favorite ways to have them as well.
Interesting. Wow, that sounds really great. Now, you're pretty much monocropping. You said you had 20-some vegetables at one time that you took to the farmer's market. You're pretty much growing the Brussels sprouts now. Does that get boring or make things standardized and simpler to do that?
I wouldn't call it boring. There's always a battle to win, but I
it's risky as a business plan to just grow one crop. I am looking to expand into some other crops. I do grow garlic and asparagus, but I would like to just have an earlier summer crop to harvest, because Brussels sprouts, it's a long season. You start them in April, and then you don't start harvesting them until August, and you go all the way till December if the weather cooperates. So it's a really long season crop, and you don't really get, you don't see rewards until later in the fall. So I'm looking at expanding into some other medicinal herbs, and cherry tomatoes, just some other crops.
Nice. We love them all. Tracy, we only have about a minute left. Can you give us one more quick recipe to send us off with and make us love Brussels sprouts all the more?
Sure. I love Brussels sprouts just, you know, shaved in a nice garden salad, you know, say with some red peppers and some cucumbers and tomatoes. I know a lot of folks for Thanksgiving like to serve a salad. And just simply, you know, just shave them in there and eat them raw. And, you know, just put your favorite salad dressing in there, and it will add a nice kick to the salad.
Yeah, the idea of shaving Brussels sprouts, I don't think, has necessarily occurred to a lot of people, and it really is a great way to prepare them and to throw them into a salad, and they are phenomenal. Jael Polskamp is the owner of Kettle Song Farm in Worcester. Jael, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
And Tracy Medeiros is a cookbook author. Her newest book is The Art of Cooking with Cannabis. That's going to be published in April. So thank you, Tracy, for joining us today with all these great recipes.
Thank you, Rick, so much for having me.
Sure thing. We'll be back after this CBS News break here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. It's a tough time to be a kid going to school. It's even tougher being a parent trying to figure out what's best for your children. Is it safe to have them in school when the number of COVID cases in Vermont and the country is soaring? Is it really good for their academic and social development to have them at home instead? Our next guest is Dr. Benjamin Lee, an associate professor of pediatrics and a pediatric infectious diseases specialist at the Larner College of Medicine at UVM. Welcome, Dr. Lee.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Lee has been studying this question closely, and he's going to help us understand this complex issue. And listeners, you can join in the discussion with your questions or thoughts. You can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Dr. Lee, what were you trying to ascertain by reviewing this data from a Shanghai investigation of community spread there?
What we were trying to do with our study was to use mathematical modeling to try to understand what impact having open schools would have on community transmission. And we wanted to look at conditions where there was a lot of community spread and how schools impacted the spread of virus even when the rest of the community needed to go into lockdown.
Why was this a good case to study?
Well, I think the this question is really one of the central questions about how we can have open schools during the pandemic. If it's, you know, if it's safe to do so, is it reasonable public health policy to say we can have open schools even if community transmission is high? We specifically used these data from Shanghai, China, mainly because they had the data sort of available in a way that would allow us to answer this question. The work that we did was based on using contact structure data, so looking at how many different contacts children of various ages are having with one another, and how that changes over childhood, and using those data to really simulate what would happen during different school opening or school closing scenarios.
Is it applicable to Vermont, this study?
Yes, I think it is. This approach, looking at contact structure data, would generally be applicable any time you have a community that has a similar contact structure. And what we see in the data set that we used is that, as would be, you know, intuitive and what we would expect, is that younger children tend to have a smaller number of social contacts, but that increases with age, with the peak number of contacts usually arriving in the teenage and young adult years. And so I think that, you know, with this study, what we're trying to look at is sort of the general principles of how communities that are structured that way can be viewed. So, you know, it's more of a general applicable study rather than one that's, you know, hyper-specific.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between how flu and COVID spread in schools?
We think that there is. We don't quite understand exactly why that is, but it's very clear at this point, and there are hints of this even all the way back in the spring. It's very clear that children are not very efficient transmitters of COVID-19. We know from experience that they are able to transmit the flu without really much problem at all. And so there do seem to be very important differences between flu and COVID-19 in children and how important children are to spreading those viruses around. Everything that we know about the COVID-19 virus tells us that children really are not important drivers of transmission.
But why are they so, use the word efficient, so efficient at spreading flu?
So, again, that's one of the fascinating aspects of this pandemic and really remains an unanswered question. So when we think of children, particularly young children, especially over the winter, the image that usually comes to mind for most folks is, you know, lots of kids with runny noses and snotty kids and that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And for most respiratory viruses, it is true that children transmit them very well. Why that is for this virus, it's still unknown. There are a number of different possibilities that have been put out there. It could be that for this virus, the role of fomite-based transmission, that is where, you know, somebody touches their nose and then touches a surface, and then that surface becomes the vehicle for transmitting to the next person.
Mm-hmm.
We know that that is far less important for this virus, and so it could be that it's more important for flu and other respiratory viruses, and that would be one potential explanation. It could be that children, when they get infected with this virus, they're able to just, you know, knock it down very quickly so that they don't have a long window of time in which they're able to spread the infection. That's another possibility. And they're just far smaller than adults. So if you have a virus that isn't replicating for a very long time in the kids anyways, and they're less able to, you know, project it out of their body, they have less forceful cough, less forceful sneeze, that would be another reason. And so it's probably a combination of all of these things. But for whatever the true reason is, what we know, you know, with a fair amount of certainty now is that children just are not as good at transmitting this virus as they are many other viruses and certainly compared to adults.
Gotcha. You did conclude that contacts in the community overall and for children 10 to 19 needed to be reduced. To what percentage of pre-pandemic levels did you want that reduced to?
Yeah, so in our study, what we did was we looked at this by looking at, you know, how many contacts are kids of different ages having in the pre-pandemic era, and what would we need to reduce that to ensure that community spread of the virus remains low. in older children who are 10 to 19 years old, we estimated that if we can reduce the total number of average daily contacts to about a third of what they would see at be experiencing at baseline, that would be one of the conditions that would allow those kids to remain in school at that, you know, the older kids in that age range. Now, this also is dependent on reducing the number of contacts that the rest of the community is making with each other as well. So it's not just contact reduction in the schools. That has to go hand in hand with contact reduction in the rest of the community.
Well, wouldn't this be a case against in-person learning?
No, I think, in fact, it would be what we're arguing is exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we see, and we see this already playing out, one of the things that our model predicts is that the schools themselves are not going to be major centers for transmission. And based on the data so far in Vermont and really the data from the rest of the country and the rest of the world, this is, in fact, what we see. The schools themselves are not where the majority of transmission is happening. And so if we target our restrictions and target our interventions for those sectors of the community where we do see transmission happening, then we can reduce transmission in that setting, and that would still enable the schools to remain open because the schools themselves are not contributing a lot to overall spread.
So even with cases surging in many Vermont communities, that doesn't make a case for all virtual learning, for removing the in-person aspect.
Correct. And, you know, what our work is showing in principle is that even if you have a lot of community spread, knowing that the schools are not going to be major areas for transmission, those are areas that can stay open. But those areas that are contributing to spread, those are where we need to see our interventions most targeted. And so it's exactly the scenario that we're seeing now is when we have more spread in the community, we need to increase our restrictions in the community and leave the schools alone.
Even with us now entering flu season, which you said, you know, does efficiently spread for children in schools, wouldn't it be a case again to keep the kids out of the schools and reduce the spread of at least the flu?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think the importance here is to recognize that what we're arguing isn't for school to go on, you know, as it had before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
We do recognize that this can only happen when we are continuing to adhere, continuing to follow the careful mitigation strategies that have been enacted in all the schools. So that would include, you know, staying home when sick, temperature checks, everybody wearing a mask, everybody practicing physical distancing, because those mitigation strategies, they will also help limit the transmission of flu. And so when we talk about the school setting, all of the things that we are proposing and that schools have been doing successfully, relatively successfully, to limit COVID-19 from spreading in the schools, those will also help with flu and other respiratory viruses as well.
So one of the silver linings of the coronavirus pandemic is that we will learn, or hopefully learn, and continue to use strategies that will, in future years, keep the flu count down and keep it from spreading.
Absolutely. I think that hopefully that is what we will see, and those can be lessons that we can take going forward. You know, in many ways, a lot of what we are being much more strict about are things that we really should be doing all along anyways, even before the pandemic came along. That means, you know, not trying to be a Superman or a hero and go to work when we're sick, or send people to, you know, send kids to school when they're sick, and paying good attention to respiratory etiquette and hand hygiene, you know, really basic things that in any year can really go a long way towards helping reduce infections of any sort in the community and in schools.
Dr. Lee, how important is in-person instruction for these children?
I think in-person instruction is absolutely critical. There really is no disagreement in the education community, in the pediatric community, that the best way for children to learn is in person. Many places have become, you know, very creative trying to improve the quality of remote learning or online learning, but it simply is not a substitute for in-person learning. Not only is in-person learning important for the educational development of children, but we also know that school does offer a number of additional services to our children and communities beyond just education. For many children, school really is the safest and most secure place for them to be due to home or community scenarios. We know that there are many children with either special needs or have other factors that necessitate services, many of which they can only access in the school setting. And finally, this is a problem still in many areas in Vermont where access to good, reliable internet is not universal. And so at the end of the day, what it means is that just from an equity issue and from a justice issue, you know, those kids who need the most support and who rely most on being at school in person, they're the ones who are going to suffer the most if they're not allowed or unable to access in-person education. So there are a whole variety of reasons why it's so crucial that we preserve in-person learning for our kids.
Does the level of importance of that in-person learning vary by age?
So I think that there are really important windows of development where we know that these are the most crucial times. In full disclosure, that is not something that I would be able to comment more specifically on than that. But again, I think if we take into account all of those other reasons for why kids need to be in school beyond just the educational advancement and development, that makes a really strong argument for why in-person learning should be preserved at all costs.
We've been focusing a lot on the children, which is really important, but I want to turn it around just a little and ask you about the safety of our teachers and school personnel who have to go in for in-person instruction.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. I think the biggest takeaway or the biggest message that I'd like to put out there is that for the teachers and the adults in the schools, the greatest risk to them is not from the children. The greatest risk to them is their interactions with each other and what they're doing outside of the school setting. And so, again, I think this comes back to the principle that really our focus has to be on what is happening among adults outside the school setting and making sure that we're following proper mitigation strategies within the schools to limit potential transmission among teachers and staff. But at the end of the day, the risk to teachers and staff isn't the kids. It's other adults, and it's really how they choose to interact with each other and around other adults that really is going to be the biggest factor in their individual risk.
Yeah, I know this is a developing virus and pandemic, and we don't know everything about it right now, but is there a level of spread in the community where even this model wouldn't hold up, where we would just absolutely have to go virtual?
So I think the scenarios, so the answer is yes, there may be scenarios where we have no other choice. The one that I am most wary of is, do we get to a position where we have so many teachers or so many staff members who catch the virus in the community and are either sick or have to quarantine such that we just literally can't conduct school in person because there just aren't enough teachers and aren't enough staff members. So that would be a scenario that I would worry about. If we get to a position where the virus is so out of control that all services are, overwhelmed, such as hospitals and that sort of thing, then, there may be scenarios where our hand will be forced. the work that we did and the modeling that the mathematical modeling that we did also provides insight, however, going in the opposite direction. If we're in a situation where everything is closed down, the same principle applies. So schools should be the last to close in the setting of increasing spread. But on the flip side, they should also be the first to reopen if the decision is made that everything has to shut down.
Over the last week or so, the vaccine news, to me, it seems to be very encouraging. What's your assessment of what we've been hearing?
I think the vaccine news has been extremely encouraging. Many of us hadn't dared to hope for a vaccine that was up to 90 or 95% effective. Our track record with vaccines for other respiratory viruses, such as influenza, it's far lower than that in terms of their efficacy. So this really was a surprise that these first studies are reporting efficacy rates as high as they have been. And I think that's, without question, it's good news. What I would say is that, these vaccines are going to probably work and work really well. And so for the first time, we really sort of see a light at the end of the tunnel in terms of our way getting out of this. Now, it's going to be a while, months even, before people can start receiving any of these vaccine doses. But I would encourage everybody to recognize that, now is the time to double down and not throw in the towel. Everybody is tired. Everybody has fatigue. But when we're so close to having effective vaccines out and available, now is the time to really double down and make sure we all make it and reach that light at the end of the tunnel rather than throwing our hands up and giving up now.
So keep taking all the precautions. Get the flu shot. I'm going to play amateur scientist here. And is the reason the efficacy of these vaccines are much higher is because we now know what this virus is, where as to the flu vaccines, they have to kind of predict ahead of time what it might be?
That certainly could be playing a role. One of the benefits, one of the things we have going in our favor with this virus is that it doesn't mutate to the extent that flu does. What makes flu so challenging is that it mutates very quickly, and just as you point out, that's the reason why we have to keep making informed guesses of what strains will be important for each upcoming flu season. With this virus, it's just the one virus, and it's not really changing very much. So that does give us a bit of an advantage in terms of targeting our vaccine towards it. And it is very closely related to some of the other to other previous viruses. And so many of the scientific community actually, in many respects, had already a bit of a head start in terms of knowing what they thought was important for this virus and what strategies might be effective.
Any idea what the timeline will look like for all of us to receive the vaccine?
So that's a great question, and it's going to roll out in phases. The state has a committee that's actually, that's doing this work, making those decisions about allocation and, what populations of people to target at each phase. I think that it's probably going to be months before, the first of us start receiving the vaccine, and it's going to be probably some months after that before it is available to the population at large. Part of the challenge is just there's a limited supply and distributing them. We never attempted trying to distribute vaccines at this scale before, so that poses its own challenges.
And with just a little bit of time left, Dr. Benjamin Lee, what are your thoughts about people getting together at the holidays?
Yeah, and this is also one of the, really critical moments for us, all. When I was mentioning the fact that we're tired and fatigued, one of the reactions to that might be to say, well, I'm going to relax just this once and have a holiday gathering see, you know, friends and family I haven't seen for a while. As hard as it is to do, I really, really would encourage everybody to recognize that is a risk. I usually spend Thanksgiving with my in-laws family. We're not doing it this year because the risk is just too high. So this really is a holiday season where we should focus on our immediate families, try to contact those that we care about and love virtually, and recognize that this isn't going to be forever. So we're just talking about delaying these types of gatherings, not saying we can never go back to them.
Immediate family in the room, everybody else on Zoom, right, Dr. Lee?
Exactly.
Dr. Benjamin Lee, Associate Professor of Pediatrics, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Mine especially. We'll get a CBS News update, then back for more of Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Under the aegis of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund is the Farm to Plate program. And the goal is to introduce you to and expand your knowledge of all the great local foods that are available to you. And that includes more than just the veggies you pick up at a farmer's market or farm stand. It includes wild game that you hunt, fish that you catch, and food you forage for. Shane Rogers is the Farm to Plate Communications Manager, and he's the sometimes star of the Vermont Wild Kitchen. Shane, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And listeners, if you'd like to ask Shane a question or share some Vermont edibles with us, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Shane, I thought Farm to Plate was kind of an idea, a concept. Is it a formal program?
Well, it's a concept, certainly, throughout the whole country and the world. But here in Vermont, we were able to kind of take that concept and really boil it down into this network of over 300 different organizations and businesses and agencies that are all coming together to work on Vermont's food system plan. So it's been pretty amazing over these past 10 years to see folks from all different walks of the food system sit down at the same table and really put their heads together to tackle some of the biggest issues facing not only farmers, but eaters as well.
And then how does that fit in or within the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund?
Sure. The Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund is the backbone organization for the Farm to Plate Network. So we have a team of 3 full-time staff that are really there to help shepherd the network. But most of the work that takes place comes from those different entities that are involved. So while we are certainly involved with the discussions, it's really the brains and the smarts of the different agencies and organizations that are choosing what they want to work on and really being able to tackle those big issues that are popping up throughout the state.
And what are you trying to do with the Farm to Plate program?
Well, there's a ton of different work that's happening, but I think the biggest thing that we're trying to do is really set up and foster this sense of collaboration among all these different actors, right? So in Vermont, we're blessed with a beautiful working landscape, with amazing local food, and with a lot of people working really hard to make local food and food available to folks throughout the state. And the network provides a platform for all of these folks to come together, to have robust conversations, and to be able to tackle problems and issues that may be a little bit bigger than just a single entity. You know, like we're able to have the Vermont Agency of Agriculture sitting down at the table with hunger relief programs and with restaurants throughout the same, where they're all batting around ideas and they're all talking about the ways in which we can make sure that folks are having access to food that is healthy and nutritious, and making sure that people are able to feed their families, and really a whole host of other issues as well.
Shane, what is the Rooted in Vermont program?
So Rooted in Vermont is a program of the Vermont Farm to Plate Network. And what Rooted in Vermont was created for was to really celebrate all the different ways that Vermonters do local food. And we created this because sometimes there's this perception in local food that it's elitist, that it's unattainable, but we really wanted to show that local food is not just $15 hamburgers or $10 beers, right? Mm-hmm. It's really anything that folks are doing, whether that's hunting and foraging, like you mentioned at the top of the show, whether that's cooking Brussels sprouts with your grandma, as you were talking about earlier in the show, or it's picking up a block of Cabot cheddar at the grocery store because that's what fits into your budget for the week, and that's the way that you want to participate in the local food movement. And what we're really trying to do with Rooted in Vermont is get out of that lane of all or nothing and really celebrate and welcome in as many people as possible, because the fact is, if we're going to change our food system and make it more accessible for anybody and everybody to be a part of, we all have to feel like we have a place at the table, and we don't want any litmus test or anything that is excluding people from that table to begin with.
Hey, let's talk wild game since you went there. I love this. What are some things that people might like if they tried it?
Oh, what are some things that they might like? The wild game has been one of my personal favorite things to work with, and working with Vermont Fish and Wildlife has just been absolutely amazing. They're such great partners, and I would say to folks who haven't grown up hunting and fishing, like myself, for instance, I consider myself an adult onset hunter. I only really picked up a gun last year and went out hunting for the first time last year. And one of the things that I think I love the most about it is just engaging with your environment in a whole new way, seeing the woods in a different way. I was always a big hiker. But being out in that mindset is just a completely different mind frame that you're going to be in. And the food is absolutely delicious. I don't know if you could find really anything much better than a backstrap of venison. Or my friends and I last year before COVID hit, you know, we smoked a bear ham for, I think it was like 12 hours, and it just enjoyed this really delicious wild game that we all hadn't eaten. And what the best part to me is that folks in Vermont have been doing this for generations, right? So we're tapping into a history when we're out in the woods. And there are a ton of people throughout the state who are willing to share that knowledge and who are willing to continue to learn and grow right along with the new hunters and the old hunters. And just that community that is being fostered around wild game, I think, is one of the best parts of seeing it as a local food part of the local food movement, because I don't know if you can really get much more local than the food that you find right in your backyard.
Yeah. So I've had the privilege of attending wild game suppers in Danville and Bolton, Tynemouth. I've had the most incredible bear pie. I've had moose sauerbraten. But that has to be donated, right? So this meat can't be sold. So we're talking about what you shoot yourself. Am I right about that when it comes to wild game?
Yeah, you're right. It definitely can't be sold. But I think one of the things that folks maybe tend to forget is that you could trade with your neighbors, right? Mm-hmm. So before I was ever hunting, one of the things that I always loved to do, you know, was like kind of make wild ferments and different fun things in jars. And I was always able to, when I was living up in the Northeast Kingdom, be able to trade something fun that I made that I pulled from the garden or got from a farm stand, you know, for a couple cuts of venison, as well. So one of the things that we really want to encourage, and through Rooted in Vermont and through the Farm to Plate Network, is, again, for folks to just experience local food however it fits best into their lives, because local food is not only delicious, but it's full of nutrients and it's healthy, and it really connects us back to that community. And especially now, when we can't go to wild game suppers and these large gatherings, are not permitted as we all work to stay safe, really connecting with nature and the working landscape in this way is a wonderful way to, I don't want to say keep sane, but to really just, kind of get out of the moment and the impending dread that kind of has been living with us since March.
And let's talk fish, because there isn't quite anything like a freshly caught fish that you then prepare. It is incredible.
Absolutely. I mean, pulling a trout out of the Winooski is one of my favorite things to do during the spring, summer, and fall. And we do this program with Vermont Fish and Wildlife. We call it the Vermont Wild Kitchen.
Yes.
And it's live streamed on our Facebook, the Rooted in Vermont Facebook, which you can find just by typing Rooted in Vermont into the search bar. And for those who maybe haven't gone fishing, don't know how to process a fish, you can tune in, and there's a lot of great instructional videos as we teach you how to not only process the fish, but cook it up. And really, the simpler the better, right? A nice hot cast iron, a big pat of butter with some salt and pepper, and you throw that trout in the pan and cook it for a couple minutes, and you just can't beat it.
And I must admit, watching Shane on that show, he's very entertaining and actually a really good cook. And let's take a call from Laura, who's calling us from Winooski. Good morning, Laura.
Yes, thank you. I really sparked up in my thinking when Shane mentioned considering trading something that you personally have produced, say, in your garden, and and then you trade it for somebody who has venison, for instance, like he mentioned. But if you've never done anything like that before, how would you know to trust the person providing the product to you that it is healthy and safe? And are there any regulations against exchanging like that? You mentioned as long as you're not selling it, but
right.
I'll take the response off the phone.
Thank you. Thanks, Laura. Shane, that's a good question. I think this is probably something you want to do with someone you do know and trust.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. It's a great question, but I think one of the things to do is just ask your friends who are out hunting. You'd be surprised at how many folks spend their afternoons and mornings in the woods here, especially during the fall time.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of the woods, foraging and wildcrafting is something that a lot of people love to do. What can people find out in the woods when they forage here in Vermont?
Oh, boy. They can find so much. The mushrooms throughout Vermont are pretty spectacular. I took up foraging a couple of years ago, and I had a pretty banner year with chanterelles, and there's everything under the sun when it comes to the mushrooms, right? Like morels and oyster mushrooms. And there's also a lot of great resources out there about eating invasives too. So like mustard green is a good example that pops up in the springtime. And it's this kind of bitter green that really you could pick and pick and pick, and you're never going to be harming the environment. And it's a great way to kind of get this invasive out of the ground that you're seeing it onto.
Yeah, you can take some of those invasives, make a nice pesto out of it or something. Yeah. But before they go for mushrooms, what should people know before going out and doing that?
Yes, one thing that you should always know is if you are not 100% certain about what you are picking, do not eat it. And that's like 100% certain. And for folks who are interested in getting involved with mushrooms, I found the best way to start is to really start by learning your trees, because then you're able to find out the mushrooms that are associated with different trees, and you're really able to then zero in and kind of look at what you're looking for. And for folks who may be a little bit nervous, there's great resources on Facebook, the Vermont Foragers page, and really finding food in your backyard in this way is such a good way for folks to supplement and to really know what food you're putting on the plate. And I know during this pandemic, for instance, folks have been really thinking a lot about that and really diving in on where and what they're eating and they're giving to their families.
And I think people who forage also do make the point that limit what you take. Never take more than half of what you see there. Only take what you're absolutely going to use. So remember, there are other people foraging who will be delighted with what's out there. Now, you mentioned the Vermont Wild Kitchen, and since we're on the subject of foraging, ramps are a wonderful thing to forage, and you did an episode where you cooked up some ramps. So tell people about ramps and what you made.
Sure. So ramps are a really excellent and good beginning foraging product to look for out in the woods. I do want to caution, though, that ramps take about 7 years to come to maturity. So if you do find a ramp patch, you want to be very, very careful with how much you're picking. You don't want to pick barely any of it. And if it's a small patch, you're more better off leaving it alone. But if you do find an excellent ramp patch, one of my favorite things to do is not only just pickle some ramps, which is pretty easy and straightforward, but you mentioned pesto, and ramp pesto is really delicious. Mm-hmm. And my friend the other week, she fermented ramps in miso, and I cannot tell you how delicious that was, being able to have that after a couple of months of sitting in the miso in her fridge. It was a really delightful treat.
Shane Rogers, what does the state need to do to provide more local foods to people?
That's such a good question, and it's such a complex question. And I really think what we saw this year, especially with the pandemic, is we saw our global and our countrywide supply chains kind of get rattled by the shutdown. And the folks who stepped up to the plate were our local farmers.
Yep.
They were the ones that were in our community. They knew what we needed, and they had the food available to make sure that our people in Vermont were able to stay fed. But the reality is that with the pandemic, we're now seeing food insecurity at higher rates than we really have seen in years. I think a recent survey just came out from UVM where about nearly 30% of Vermont households reported to be food insecure between March and September. And if you're making less than $50,000, you are six times as likely to be food insecure. So we're seeing how this pandemic and how our food system really makes the most vulnerable even more vulnerable. But the good news is that there's a lot of really great people that are working on this problem. Programs like Everyone Eats is popping up. We had the Vermont Farm to Family boxes, and organizations like Hunger Free Vermont and NOFA Vermont and the Vermont Food Bank are doing excellent work in the community, and they are helping people access not only healthy and nutritious food, but also local food, which is keeping the money in our economy and making sure that our farmers are getting and keeping the money that they need and deserve to keep growing this delicious food.
Now, I think you're working on kind of the future of all this with a big new 10-year plan. And when will we see, what comes to fruition from that?
That's a great question, Rick. So the Vermont Farm to Plate Network just wrapped up the first 10 years. And what we are doing right now is really working to imagine what the next 10 years in the Vermont food system is going to look like. And that kind of is coming in the form of these briefs that are being put out. And we're putting out dozens of briefs where experts and farmers and eaters from around the state are contributing. I think you might be hearing the F-35s. Oh. Flying overhead. Welcome to Vermont.
There you go.
But these briefs are touching on things from products to markets to issues, and they are identifying the state of how it's of those products. They're identifying the bottlenecks and really looking into what our next steps are going to be. And the amount of knowledge that is out there and the amount of people that are dedicated to making sure that our food system here in Vermont is for everybody and is accessible by anybody is pretty staggering and very impressive. And I am never ceased to be amazed at the work that folks are doing throughout the state on these issues.
Shane Rogers is the Farm to Plate Communications Manager at the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. Shane, I want to thank you so much for making us so very hungry today.
I appreciate it. I'm glad lunch is coming up soon. And thank you so much for having me, Rick. I hope to be on again soon.
Absolutely. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and directed by Peter Cormier. I'm Rick Singeri, and I'll meet you here again tomorrow.